And like we actually brought him out here to do a screening of his film at the Carnegie Museum of Art. And yeah, and it's just kind of like it's nuts that this guy who's internationally famous for his film gets like zero recognition in Pittsburgh from the arts community. And he found all of his success in New York. Yeah, just like definitely not much interest from the fine art scene in the graffiti scene.
Well, hopefully that's going to, you know, change in the future, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Pittsburgh is notoriously behind the times on many things, which is one reason why, like, I have my mural career, because it's just starting off here, the mural scene, where every other city, it had started, like, in the 90s. So Pittsburgh is, like, just starting to accept graffiti art, muralism, and just kind of, like, the aesthetics of graffiti. Pittsburgh is, like, just starting to, like, accept, like, the culture of it as well.
Sure, yeah. I think that's just about all the time we have, but you've been listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Again, I'm one of your hosts, Archon Das, with
Kate Smiggy.
And we've been talking to Max Gonzalez, graffiti artist. Thanks, Max. Has been great having you on the show.
Thank you.
Have a good one.
WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. My name's Anthony Cachado, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Well, good morning, everybody. It is a absolute pleasure to be back here in the studio with you all today at the wee hour of 9:30 in the morning. I haven't done something this early in a long time, so we're getting back into the groove of that. But just a quick heads up before we get into things. Everything that I'm about to say on this program is not necessarily representative of the views of those at WRCT, but strictly those of myself. Now, this show, for those of you who have not listened before, this is called The Angry Young Man. Now, why call it The Angry Young Man? Why sound so angry at the world, fist in the air, and, you know, things of that sort and manner? Well, to put it quite simply, there's a lot to be peeved about right now, and unfortunately, as much as I would have loved for it to be a little less peeve-inducing over the past couple months as I stepped away from this show for the summer, it got worse, because doesn't it always somehow find a way to get so much worse? Today we're just going to kind of do a little recap of the summer. You know, what wonderful, beautiful things do we now have to contend with as we enter this fall over here, as I continue to keep you in the loop about some of the things that just aren't right. So, yeah, for those of you who haven't tuned in before, this is a show where I'll either kind of sit here rambling like a madman at a inanimate object, this being the microphone, for about 30 minutes, or I'll bring in a friend or a knowledgeable individual, or who knows, maybe someone more later on this semester, just to kind of talk. Because at the end of the day, as angry as we can be about things, it's critical that we're able to sit down kind of face to face, look at each other, and talk about something that we might have severe disagreement on and might feel very strongly about, but be able to walk away from that conversation or have a conversation that, you know, you ultimately feel like you're being heard, you're being respected. And you don't even have to be, like, an expert in the field. Just, like, sit down and talk like two people going out to grab coffee. Like, that's the essence of what this is. Because, quite frankly, there's not enough of it. And I feel like this bears saying pretty often, especially on a program that has the distinct purpose of kind of bearing that message. Because just people aren't being people with each other anymore, which is unfortunate. You know, we're all angry young men and women, And those among us that are not really willing to, you know, kind of tone it down and, you know, be able to listen. But anyways, that's enough talking about that. What's been going on? Because there has been so much that has happened. I think that it bears talking about the fact that Biden dropped out of the race. This is like I'm digging this news out of its grave after it was kind of kicked to death and then buried somewhere very far away. And about 30 years later, I'm digging it up for the purpose of like being Frankenstein and creating this monster. I mean, like that's still kind of crazy that this happened. I mean, last season, something that definitely came up as I was talking with people was the concern surrounding the ability of the president to kind of function in that role and especially prove that he was ready to take on another 4 years. I mean, you know, actually, I'm not kicking a dead horse. The reason being, that man is still our president. And if we've decided to gently escort him off the stage and no longer run him for president of the United States, it still bears mentioning that that man is still in charge of many a things, being the, you know, commander-in-chief, the president. It's, you know, a little concerning to say the least that we've kind of forgotten about that in the midst of campaigning and campaign-related what have you. I mean, it's attractive to talk about the campaign. It's not so attractive to talk about the fact that we're potentially committing elder abuse by putting that man through the rest of his term. Yeah, I mean, there's been little, if any, commentary on what's going on from the White House, as far as I've been able to see. Which I may be wrong. I try to keep relatively in the loop. The one thing, though, that I did see, which, oh boy, is this a fun topic. I'll probably like to bring someone on to talk about it at some point. Biden crawled out of the woodworks to announce the intention he has to to block the sale of U.S. Steel to Nippon Steel. Now, for those of you who are unaware of this little business fiasco that's been going on, so U.S. Steel, being the steel company in the United States, I mean, we're in Pittsburgh, we're in like the steel, we're the steel city, we're the heart of it all, you know, anyone with a pair of eyes and a cursory understanding of what a downtrodden city looks like in some places would know that the past has not been too kind to the steel industry in Pittsburgh. You know, we've rebounded in many places, but there are still very much scars of that throughout the city. So kind of you have steel U.S. Steel, which is on its last leg, kind of just limping through to the present. And, you know, that between that and the union contract situation with the United Steelworkers, it's not looking too hot for U.S. Steel. You know, in comes Nippon Steel, a Japanese-based steel company, is basically saying, you know, hey, we're willing to step in here save your butt. So that's where that was at. And then all of a sudden, the alarm bells ring, not only for Democrats, but for Republicans, too. This is something that I've mentioned in the past, but is something that is extremely concerning, to say the least. Both parties are very, very, very wary of the idea of a foreign company investing in the United States. There is this immediate, like, knee-jerk reaction to say no immediately out the gate to conditions of free trade with our allies. Japan, you know, has been our close ally for many, many, many years, and is especially a closer ally now. You know, this isn't 1944 where we're in the midst of a full-scale Pacific campaign against them. They're one of our closest partners in East Asia. I mean, we should be just fine having them invest in us, especially when the investment means saving many jobs in the United States, keeping operations within the United States, and not only saving jobs, but saving union jobs. If that's the big concern, you're keeping it just fine. You're honoring contracts with unions through this deal. I mean, it's, you know, you're not real. There's not really too much objectionable in this deal unless you are outright objected to the idea that a foreign nation invests in our country. All this to say, so you have one of the few areas that both presidential candidates agree on, but also at the same time, the current president agrees on. It's disappointing, to say the least, that we've kind of, in the popular mind, just decided free trade was no longer the direction we're going. We're going to, you know, just go full send protectionism because, you know, why, you know, if we somehow manage to, you know, free trade too much, then we destroy the domestic job industry, which is, you know, like, it, from a surface level, I get where people come from with that, but it's, there's a reason that your toaster costs $10 instead of like $70, and it's because it's produced somewhere where they have the ability to do so cheaply and lower your cost of living significantly. So, all this to say, there's this wonderful, fun little attitude across the entire board that we should completely forget that gains from trade are a thing and that competitive advantage is a thing. You know, let's just forget that some countries are inherently better at producing X good faster or cheaper. And attempt to do it at home. And not only are we going to make it more expensive to buy those things, but we're going to take away from our ability as a country to produce things that we're good at doing. And then inevitably lose out on the gains from exporting that across the world. And we're all worse off. Because, and I've said this to people before, the problem with looking at gains from free trade in comparison to losses from free trade is that your losses from free trade are a very tangible, small subset of people. You can think of it this way. Like, if we have free trade and immediately it becomes easier for people producing, let's just say cars. Cars are a pretty good example. So it becomes cheaper to make cars in Japan or China. The auto industry loses 20,000 jobs in Bend, Idaho? Is it? No, it's not Idaho. It's one of the I's. Indiana? Mayor Pete's from there. South Bend. Anyways, so you have this loss of jobs of like 20,000 people. And these 20,000 people, you know, obviously that's a tragedy. But 20,000 people lost their job. And then pretty much the entire rest of the country just received a discounting to their cost of living. Which means that it's easier for someone now to, you know, take a day off here or there and spend more time with their family or save up to buy a nicer house or a nicer car or go on vacation, stuff like that. You have very dispersed benefits that come from the free trade as opposed to a very concentrated loss that, you know, is just easier to see. You know, it's very hard to visualize for the average person, the benefit of, you know, everything costs $10 less now for you on average. You know, your whole basket of goods is now $10 less than it was last year or 5 years ago. You know, that's, I mean, yes, it's tangible, but it's a little less tangible than seeing 20,000 people rioting outside of Mayor Pete's mayoral hall in South Bend saying they want their jobs back. That's the problem there. I'm concerned that what used to be the consensus on free trade up until about the 2010s is a thing of the past. The reason being, you know, we're already getting hammered by the cost of living on other fronts. I mean, it doesn't take more than maybe about a 10-second scroll on Zillow to want to gouge out your eyeballs and forget that the housing market is a thing, because you will never be able to afford a house as a young person at this rate. Or even if you can, it will be extremely painful to buy one. So, I mean, the cost of that end of living is ridiculous. The cost of farm goods to begin with, eggs, milk, basics, staple goods are up. A lot of that has to do with the upward pressure on prices from inflation. That's a whole thing in of itself. I mean, you know, obviously we're not feeling 2022 levels of inflationary pressure right now, but we haven't exactly rectified many of the root causes there. So, you know, isn't it a wonderful thing to realize how kind of screwed we are in some ways as a young generation financially? And all this to say that it isn't exactly helping that we're increasing the cost of living on imported goods by becoming increasingly protectionist. But here's a fun little segue into some stuff going on I'd like to elaborate more on at another point, going into the issues regarding some policy proposals from the Harris-Walz campaign. That policy list dropped in full, I believe it was either yesterday or 2 days ago. And, you know, we knew some of these things already just because of the scattered tweet here or remark made at a speech there. The big objectionable stuff I've spoken about before, firstly, price controls and how well that's worked for countries like Argentina and Venezuela. Not well is the answer. but I do want to say before we get into that, I do have a couple things I need to let you guys know about. Just in my capacity as Mr. Member of WRCT over here. Firstly, I just want to let you know a little bit about an organization called Big Brothers and Big Sisters of Greater Pittsburgh. Who brought you a little magic in your life growing up? Who took you to your first ball game? Who showed you how to find the North Star? Who made you laugh so hard your stomach hurt? This time, become the one who makes magic happen for a young person by becoming a big sister or a big brother. Being a big brother or big sister is something that almost anyone can do. Just be a friend to a child who needs one. Have fun together. Learn from each other. Help a child discover these little moments that are so magical for a young person, and you will both be forever changed by the experience. Call Big Brothers, Big Sisters to learn more about their varied and flexible mentoring opportunities at 412-363-6100. That's 412-363-6100, or visit them online at www.BBSPGH.org. That was BBSPGH.org. Big Brothers, Big Sisters, Little Moments, Big Magic. Also, just gonna let you know very quickly, also, in addition, you know, how many little segue words can I put there? WRCT is supported by Sidecar Bakery in North Oakland. Sidecar is an independent coffee shop with a full bar, ready-made breakfast sandwiches, breakfast pastries, savory hand pies, cakes, and pies made in the bakery next door. Sidecar offers a place to study, eat, and hang with friends in a cafe setting. Open 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday, and 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Sunday. For more information, visit their website at sidecar412.com. If you're interested in underwriting for WRCT, you can email pr@wrct.org for more information about promotional exchanges and other partnership opportunities. Well, anyways, after that little brief interlude there, let's hop back into the saddle for a second in these last 10 minutes I got with you. So, yeah, price controls. Why are they a bad thing? Well, let's look at it this way. There's a certain point, there's a certain amount of demand for, let's say, I'll use pizza. Pizza's a fun one. There's a certain amount for pizza in the world. Well, let's say the United States. There's a certain amount of demand for pizza in the United States. There's only so many people who can supply pizza in the United States. And at a certain point, the amount that they're going to produce and the demand that there is for pizza is going to intersect on a graph. And that's what we call the kind of like optimal point for pricing because or production. You'll produce just enough pizza to meet all the demand for the pizza. And that price, whatever price that ends up being, is the price that it's best to sell pizza at. Now, the government might say, well, you're selling pizza for too much. Nobody is able to afford pizza because you're charging too much for pizza. Let's cut back the price of pizza. We're going to ask you, instead of selling a 12-inch, 16-inch pie for $20, you're selling it for $15 now. Have fun. Now, what that does is that artificially restrains the amount that you could sell it for, yes, which means that you're going to pull it below the price, but if you're still going to, you're still going to have the same amount of demand and the same amount of supply. What ends up happening is you have a lot more people that want to buy it at that price, but it's not worth it to produce more at that point. As a matter of fact, at that price, you're going to want to produce less. So what you end up with is the double whammy of more people want it because it's cheaper, but less producers able to make less. So what does that end up looking like? It ends up looking like empty shelves at grocery stores. It ends up looking like empty display cases at the pizzeria. And I'll tell you, there's nothing more sad than walking into a pizzeria just as they're closing and all of the pizza is off the counter and you're left with the option of that very weird slice that nobody orders or absolutely nothing. That is the unfortunate result of price controls. We'll go into that a little more at a later time with someone in a more engaging conversation than me kind of yapping at the mic. But another wonderful thing to consider is, in a similar vein, the down payment assistance in the Harris-Walz plan for first-time homebuyers. What could possibly go wrong when you subsidize demand? I'll tell you exactly what goes wrong. If people are able to pay more, they are going to, on average, be able to buy the thing. And that's going to increase the demand. By subsidizing demand, the amount of demand will increase. And oftentimes, sometimes supply is able to catch up. But even if supply doesn't catch up, if either of the two happens, it's likely that you're going to end up with a higher price point because they know now that they can charge a higher price point. So you end up with higher costs by subsidizing demand. Also not good. You are, in both of those proposals, making it significantly worse by trying to solve the problem. What's the moral of the story there? More government is not necessarily a good thing. In many cases, and actually quite a few, less government is where you're looking for the solution. That is a kind of a staple message of the angry young man. In whatever I'll talk about, it somehow finds its way to land back there. But that's what you get when you put a small L libertarian on the radio. all this to say, there's a lot going on right now. I'm excited to kind of see how things develop as we go further into this year, because, you know, we're in the midst of a interesting election, one in which we're going to definitely see some things to be angry about, some very stupid things will be said. I doubt that much of wisdom will be said in this cycle, which is unfortunate how far we've lowered the bar, something to be angry about. Who knows? But, yeah, I mean, we're looking at maybe the potential to have a call-in option. That would be something I would like to do if I could figure out the logistics on it. Might need to get a producer in the room with me, because you just have me finagling the little sliders here to make this happen today. But if we can get a producer, who knows? Maybe we can do some call-in, you know, like get you guys in the mix. What do you think about what's going on? You're also free to have a chat with me afterwards, not on the air, if you'd like to. If you heard something objectionable, if you'd like to suggest something that we speak about in the future, by all means. This is why we call it Freeform Radio. You could call us over here at 412-268-9728. Again, 412-268-9728. Or if you like letters, you can call 412-CMU-WRCT. Again, 412-CMU-WRCT. If you happen to be hearing this when it's airing on Thursday, I have very bad news. I am not currently in the station. I am somewhere, probably asleep, because it's going to be airing sometime around 8:30 on a Thursday. And if I don't have anything to do before 9 o'clock, it's likely I will not be awake before then. So you will be calling an empty station. I'm very sorry to report that, but feel free to call now after the show. You know, always appreciate a good talk. It doesn't have to be on the air. Anyways, all this to say, we're looking at like, I don't know, three-ish minutes left on the clock. What are some other things we may address this season? I think that it would be worth talking about again, potentially just general topics, not necessarily stuff that's of crazy relevance. I know that we're definitely going to have a return talk on the market environmentalism topic. The person I spoke to about that has some revisions to make to their statements. So we will revisit that topic. I believe we're definitely going to find ourselves talking about some of the third party candidates, seeing what's going on there. Especially with, actually, funny little story for those of you not in the loop. Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, was filing to put her name on the ballot in Nevada. Now, what happened was the Nevada Secretary of State either intentionally or unintentionally gave them the paperwork to file for a petition to put a referendum on the ballot. So they did all the paperwork. They got the signatures, submitted it. It turns out what they submitted was the paperwork to put to question Jill Stein, and you either voted yes or no. The implications of such a referendum would be interesting. I wonder what happens when 80% of Nevada votes no on Jill Stein. It seems like there's a rather insidious sort of outcome to that. But anyways, all of this to say, welcome back to The Angry Young Man. We're going to continue going at it every Tuesday at 9:30. We're going to talk, and we're going to talk about the things that aren't necessarily getting the coverage, and maybe some of the stuff that's getting the coverage. We're going to have fun while we're at it. We're going to, you know, hopefully keep it cool, keep it going. You know, this is the fun stuff. I have a lot of fun stuff on the pipeline for you. Some fun surprise stuff we might get further down the line. Who knows? But it was a pleasure to be back with you all today. I'll see you all sometime next week. Hope you all have a wonderful, spectacular rest of your Tuesday or Thursday, depending on when you're listening. And we'll speak further soon. You all take care and have a blessed rest of your day.
I'm Jimmy Boss.
And I'm Juan Garcia.
And we are back in 2025 for Season 2 of Vamos Verde.
We give you an inside look at Austin's Major League Soccer team, Austin FC.
And we also give you a deeper look into the art and culture surrounding the team and the city of Austin.
The players.
The artists.
People you know.
People you need to know.
Listen to Vamos Verde every other week from KUT Radio, part of the NPR network. The University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
Back in, I'll call it 2015, 2016, now just kind of started seeing the shift towards, you know, fashion within sports, right? Whether it was what a guy's wearing on draft night or what's Russell Westbrook wearing walking into the game this week, you know, what's Cam Newton wearing walking into the game. So I just started to see that blend, and I just had the thought, like, you know, man, you know, this could, you know, what if there was a way to represent your favorite team or your alma mater, your college, with a suit?
Carlton Dixon, former star high school and collegiate basketball player, high school coach and athletic director, and founder and CEO Reveal Suits. In 2018, former high school athletic director and basketball coach and University of Texas at Austin alum Dixon launched Reveal Suits. Reveal Suits specializes in crafting high-quality custom suits and blazers for both men and women. Today, Reveal Suits has licenses for 90 colleges and is generating over $1 million a year. The company has landed apparel contracts to suit up inductees for the College Football Hall of Fame, National Soccer Hall of Fame, and members of the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame for bowl games, the NFL Alumni Association, HBCU All-Stars, the Ivy League, and the Big 12 Conference. I'm John L. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Reveal Suits with founder and CEO Carlton Dixon, In Black America.
I was a student of, you know, of course, basketball, but I was also, you know, I was wanting to know and get a better insight into just kind of the madness behind what was on the court. I wanted to, you know, I was interested in the marketing, and I was interested in how they would reach out to the local elementary schools and get them involved. You know, I was just wanting to know a lot about just the machine that was Texas Athletic. And I think I knew at that time that I was going to end up being, you know, I actually was more focused on becoming an athletic director than I was a coach, but fortunately, I ended up accomplishing both.
As a national merit finalist and basketball All-American, Carlton Dixon was enjoying a successful career as a high school basketball coach, then as an athletic director, when the idea for reveal suits came upon him. By watching the NBA or NFL draft, Dixon would see athletes wearing creative suits that often represented their colleges, so he thought he would distribute personalized suits with officially licensed lining before the big-name apparel companies could beat him to it. Founded in 2018, Reveal Suits' first big break came when Atlanta the contract to make Reveal Suits for Florida State and Baylor football teams. Dixon was a three-year letterman with the University of Texas men basketball program, and in 1998 he earned a bachelor's degree in speech communication from the university. Reveal Suits is a minority and veteran-owned company based in Dallas, Texas, and the company is now one of the growing brands in the fashion industry. Recently, in Black America, spoke with founder and CEO Carlton Dixon.
Raised in Dallas. I was born in Chicago. Stayed there for about 6 years and then moved to Dallas back in, 81 now. I'm dating myself, but grew up in Dallas, in the South Dallas area, inner city area of Dallas. You know, just all kind of great life experiences there. I had the pleasure of winning a state championship at Lincoln High School. Should have had two of them, but that's a whole nother story. And then went on to play at University of Texas and got my degree in communications. And just kind of shaped me for the rest of what was to come.
I heard that. Brothers and sisters?
Yes, sir. Well, the short story is that it's me and my sister Carlisa Dixon, who has emerged as just one of the top high school coaches in the state of Texas. She's just a phenomenal girls basketball coach. And then the long, long story is that I'm one of 13 when you include all of my father's children. So, you know, heavy, you know, back in Chicago, a lot of them back in Chicago still. And we all have great relationships. So, part of a loving family on both sides.
I heard that. When did you develop that love for basketball?
Oh, man. I'm going to take you back to the fourth grade, the Oak Cliff Lakers, man, playing in the YMCA over at the Keys YMCA. You know, got together with some school friends, and, you know, we just began to play and practice every week. And then I began to play for our elementary school's team as well, and just realized that, you know, I might have had a little something. And you know, middle school just began to develop my game and going to camps. I was at the SMU basketball camp every summer under Billy Tubbs, John Shoemate, both have passed on, but just some incredible teachers of the game. And you know, By the ninth grade, I was just kind of like, I was starting on varsity, and I was just like, okay, I think we may have something here. And just kept being a student of the game and learning the game, and the rest is history. Just fortunate to have a great career after that.
I heard that. What did you find special about those state championship teams?
Man, you know, it's just something about doing it with the guys that were from the neighborhood, right? You know, just, you know, we were a bunch of inner city kids. You know, everybody's got, you know, their respective challenges and setbacks, you know, as a product of being in the inner city. But man, when it came to that basketball court, man, we had one common goal. We were 15 brothers that were just determined to accomplish that goal. And I think, you know, being where we were from South Dallas, having to overcome, you know, things that, you know, most other players from other schools didn't have to overcome. And so by us being able to do that and, you know, keep the focus, you know, keep on top of our grades as well. Just special, man. Just real special. And you know, those are my brothers even to this day.
Was UT the only one that came calling?
No, I was I was fortunate to get just some incredible home visits. You know, I had, of course, Coach Penders, who ended up, winning me over. But, you know, he was competing with Lute Olson from Arizona, Stu Jackson when he was coaching at Wisconsin at the time, Gene Katie at Purdue. So it actually came down to Purdue in Texas. And I was a real big fan of Coach Katie's, you know, that Big Ten style. I just think at the end of the day, you know, Texas was run and gun. They were on TV and it was close to home to where friends and family could still come and watch me play. And yeah, no regrets at all. Like I said, it was, you know, I had four or five great final choices. You know, fortunate to, you know, I still know where my box of letters is at my mom's house. You know, so I was just fortunate to get letters from all over the country, man. But, you know, UT ended up being a special place. And, zero regrets.
Now, what was it about UT that helped you make that transition into athletics as one, as a coach, and then as an athletic director?
Yeah, man, I used to be, I was a student of, you know, of course, basketball, but I was also, you know, I was wanting to know and get a better insight into just kind of the madness behind what was on the court. I wanted to, you know, I was interested in the marketing, and I was interested in how they would reach out to the local elementary schools and get them involved. You know, I was just wanting to know a lot about just the machine that was Texas Athletic. And I think I knew at that time that I was going to end up being, you know, I actually was more focused on becoming an athletic director than I was a coach. But fortunately, I ended up accomplishing both. And I just remember, you know, just being there and, you know, walking into, you know, whether it was Kurt Flood's office at the time or the Lost Dodds at the time, just wanted to know just what was making this big machine turn. And, you know, I was just really interested in the behind the scenes stuff and just hoped one day that I would be able to do that at some level. And I ended up being able to accomplish that at the high school level. So, you know, I was just grateful that, you know, that nobody ever kicked me out of their office when I wanted to learn a little bit more.
Now, you was at North Dallas High School as the coaching athletic director. Was that your choice or Dallas Independent School District's choice?
When I saw the vacancy, and I remember at the time, it was the summer of 2011. I saw the vacancy and I knew that was my choice. I mean, that was my, that was my time. North Dallas, you know, being a long time, you know, DISD kid, you know, North Dallas was that school. It was the easy victory, right? You know, they had their challenges from an overall athletic standpoint. They weren't really known for, you know, basketball, football, baseball. That, you know, had a strong, you know, tennis and soccer program, but, you know, it was that school that wasn't high on the radar from an athletic standpoint. And so I actually embraced that and I wanted to go in and put my stamp on it, you know, from a culture standpoint. You know, yeah, we may not have the track record of the best basketball, the best football, but why can't we change that? And so I was, you know, I was hyped up to get the job to change the culture. And I believe in my 3 years that culture was changed. And I'm still a fan of what they're doing over there now, still building, you know, and perhaps they won't reach from the basketball football standpoint, maybe they won't reach the heights of a Lincoln or a South Oak Cliff or a Kimball, but I was very, very proud of what we were able to accomplish and just to see, you know, how their mindsets changed and they kind of adopted my mentality of why not us, right? And it was just good to see those small victories over there that we were able to accomplish. And like I said, I'm still a big fan, big supporter of what they have going on there.
Being a former athlete yourself and the students knowing that, what were some of the challenges that you had to overcome and why was it important for you to kind of nurture these young men?
I think that, you know, from my basketball team standpoint, they saw how much of a competitor I still was. Like at that time, you know, I was still mid-30s, man. So, you know, still, I was still, you know, cocking that thing behind my head at that, you know, during that time. And so I say that to say that I think they saw how, whether it was, you know, me coaching them or me playing against them, I think they saw what my mentality was. And I was just like, hey, if you're on the other side, whoever you are, I'm still trying to kill you. And I think that they saw that repeatedly in me, to where they were like, oh shoot, we need to get down like that. And I think it helped, you know, and I, you know, still hear from a few of them to this day, you know, just kind of thanking me for that mindset that we were able to instill. And like I said, before I got there, it was just, you know, hey, we're just doing this just to do it. But I was just like, oh, anytime I step on this floor, we're not doing it just to do it. We're doing it to win. And I could slowly start seeing that attitude being developed. And, you know, I was, like I said, I think in 3 years, I was able to empower those young men. And then as an athletic director, even the young women on the women's sports, just able to empower them to think the same way. And hey, let's change the culture here. And so, you know, that was a very rewarding experience for me, you know, knowing, you know, for the most part that there weren't going to be any state championships. There weren't going to be any, you know, huge, huge accolades, but to see the culture that changed, the way the culture changed, the way that we were able to instill confidence in those young men and women, man, that was huge for me. So definitely thankful for that.
You're listening to In Black America with Johnny O. Hanson Jr. We'll be back in just a moment.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with Carlton Dixon, former high school and college basketball star, coach, athletic director, and founder and CEO of Real Suits. Mr. Dixon, when did you come up with the idea of apparel? Obviously, you was having a successful career in high school as a coach and athletic director, and you pivoted. Why so?
Yeah, man, back in, I'll call it 2015, 2016 now, just kind of started seeing the shift towards, you know, fashion within sports, right? Whether it was what a guy's wearing on draft night, or what's Russell Westbrook wearing walking into the game this week, you know, what's Cam Newton wearing walking into the game. So I just started to see that blend, and I just had the thought, like, you know, man, you know, this could, you know, what if there was a way to represent your favorite team or your alma mater, your college, you know, with a suit, you know, all of the Longhorn stuff that I had in my closet at the time, a polo, a sweatshirt, a cap, a t-shirt. And I was like, man, I don't have a suit. Like, this would be next level. And so it really just the whole vision just began from I wonder if this is even possible. And so I just started playing with some different just kind of visions in my head. And I can't, you know, I landed at the inner lining concept, and I started, you know, just kind of putting it out there to, you know, a few people who I kind of trusted who were, you know, already in the collegiate sports space. And just kind of getting their feedback, like, hey, give me honest feedback on this. Would you buy this for your players? Would you rep this as a coach? Would you, you know, just kind of what, you know, any forms of those questions. And I just got nothing but positive feedback. And, you know, the process clearly is not as cut and dry and as simple as I'm, you know, making it out to be, perhaps. It was a, you know, once I decided to go for it, it was a good 15-month process from a licensing standpoint, from the standpoint of just learning about the industry, getting my supply chain together. You know, I'm a communications major, man. I didn't I didn't go to school for anything, you know, like this. And so it was a big learning curve for me if this was what I wanted to explore. And, you know, made a decision to, you know, my wife and I, we were just like, hey, let's go for it. And, you know, and that's exactly what we did. And so it was really just trying to figure out if this product, this new product, yeah, I wasn't creating a new garment. The suit's been around for 300 years, but putting that different spin on it from a college license standpoint, that's what I was determined to do. And, you know, so far, so good.
Now, you came up with the idea for the inner lining. You know, we see patches on the outside, on the pocket. So when you came up with that particular thought, how did you envision the inner lining looking like?
Yeah, it was, I knew that was the direction I wanted to go. And it, you know, from an inner lining standpoint, number one, I thought it was a very subtle way to accomplish what I was trying to accomplish. I think, you know, I had the thought of, you know, okay, do I put this Longhorn on the outside? Nah, that may limit, you know, where I can wear the suit. And, you know, probably can't walk up in just a general, you know, kind of setting.
You couldn't walk on A&M campus with that.
Yeah.
Okay,
right?
I got you.
And so, you know, it was just one of those things. I was just like, okay, this inside route, I think is the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, how can I make this happen? And so then it was just a matter of research and development, and, you know, I probably went through 20 different suppliers to get some samples made. And, you know, I found one that found, you know, that checked all of the boxes I was looking for, because I wanted to know that they could do, you know, both male and female suits. I wanted to know that the turnaround time was good. It was just quite a few boxes that I wanted to be checked. And we ended up finding that supplier, and everything was able to come together. And within a few weeks after I officially put it out there, I had Florida State football and Baylor football ready to buy for their entire teams. And so once that happened, I was like, okay, this is game on now. No looking back.
Now, when you got those initial contracts, was it someone overwhelming? Said, now, you know, it's show and tell. Now I got to produce.
Yes, it was. and if, you know, if anybody that was in that position said otherwise, I'd have to look at them upside down a little bit.
I know that's right.
It was, you know, that's just, you know, it's the show and tell. It's the pressure. Thankfully, I've been able to draw, you know, I mean, as crazy as it sounds, I draw from the experience that I had in big games, right? In eight title games, in March Madness games, you know, it's game on now. And so you got to rise to the occasion. And so I took that very seriously. I made sure that things were, you know, done properly, in place, that this whole experience that we were about to give these teams is going to be very efficient.
Mm-hmm.
And I just took that very seriously. And thankfully it was all able to come together real, really good.
Now, what is it? Is it a standard turnaround time, or it depends on how many garments you need to produce?
Depends on the number. I mean,
okay.
But my turnaround times are good, even from an individual suit standpoint, maybe up until about, call it 25 suits, 25 garments. My turnaround time is right at about 3 weeks. Now, if we're doing a big football team, typically that goes to about 4 to 5 weeks, which is still, you know, which is still very well received, still very good, you know, within the industry, within the market. And so we're very proud and happy about the turnaround times and where we've gotten those to.
Now, when the teams come to you, either be collegiate or professional, obviously the licensing is probably part of that agreement. But talk to us about that process of, one, a professional sports franchise is obtaining licenses, and also the other collegiate schools, that process that you have to go through to, you know, to get they okay to use their logos.
Yeah, so the collegiate space, you know, that's you got to go through the NCAA for that. you know, they have a licensing entity you go through, and you know, there's all kind of due diligence that they do about your company, your brand. You want to make sure that you're in compliance with all the colors and knowing the do's and don'ts from a trademark standpoint. You know, they're going to look at your supply chain, make sure that everything's on the up and up there. And like I said, it was a good year plus process. And so they're going to do a deep dive of your company, make sure that at the end of the day, making sure that they can trust us as the company to deliver these goods that represents the brands that they govern. You know, there's been a lot of counterfeit stuff that's gone out over the years. And so they're going to make sure that you're legit. And that's why it takes the length of time that it did. But I was dead set on seeing the process through, and yeah, we made it on the other side.
Talk to us about the University of Texas program that they initiated for one, alumnus, but also having you part of a program for minorities to participate in doing business with the UT.
Yeah, you know, of course, just coming back home and to be able to have, you know, the alma mater support the brand. We became an official partner back in 2020, which kind of helped set the tone for a lot of the business that we have there now. You know, a lot of the faces, you know, some of the faces that were there when I was playing, you know, who are still there, okay. played big roles in you know, helping us get across the finish line from a business standpoint. You know, there's still the licensing piece that you got to go through, and nobody can escape that. But I think that they were very excited to, you know, get Reveal on board. You know, the story just was a great story. Former student athlete, former player, guy who graduated in 4 years. Now he's coming back to provide our current student athletes from all sports with this professional attire that also represents the Longhorn brand. So I'm very grateful to, you know, Chris Plonsky, you know, Coach Conrad, even in her retirement, just being an advocate for the brand, even back when Shaka was there, just really been fortunate to have some great support from some of those leaders like that. And I'm sure it's a few other names that I'm, you know, failing to remember, but just some really good support once we were ready to activate our presence there on the 40 acres.
I found it interesting when I was doing research for this conversation. Obviously, you're familiar with Orange, but when the NBA came calling the Hall of Fame, you all had to research a certain type of orange. And what was that like when you got that phone call and say, we want you to outfit our inductees?
Man, the craziest day that I can remember. I remember almost what I had on. And I remember the time of day.
Right.
I was sitting in my office, and just to see Naismith Hall of Fame even appear on my caller ID, just thought it was a joke. And to hear that, number one, that they have just been watching our activity on social media, on LinkedIn, that was just phenomenal to hear. And then for them to tell us that they wanted us, not were we interested, but to hear them tell us that they wanted us and they have been advised to come and find us, you know, as a former Hooper, that was just, I mean, that was incredible to me. You know, just knowing that this sport that I love and live, breathe, eat, sleep, that the highest of the highest in that sport was, you know, a fan of ours and wanted to align themselves with us, man. It was just, that was a surreal day. I remember calling my wife as soon as I got off the phone, and I was just like, you won't believe what just happened. And, you know, I mean, of course, it took some business negotiations to make everything work. But to see how they wanted us and wanted to integrate Reveal into what they were doing and how they wanted to elevate the Naismith Hall of Fame brand, you know, just couldn't be more grateful. I mean, Jerry Colangelo and, you know, all those. I mean, it was just it's just surreal. Every year we do it, and we're coming up on our fifth year right now, and every year we're there, it still just seems unreal. And you know, for me, it's just one of the biggest validations of, you know, man, we may really be doing something. Just one of the biggest validations that Reveal has ever had.
Carlton Dixon, founder and CEO of Reveal Suits. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessary, though, of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again, for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
In Black America and KUT Public Radio are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters helping to bring diversity to the airwaves. You can find